This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at MOFAD.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, schools, cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right. Welcome to the Main Course OG. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's. I'm your host, Patrick Martins.
Hello, Patrick.
That is Mike Edison, the co-host.
Hello, Mike.
Our guests.
Where's Emily today?
Emily is in Cartagena.
Cartagena?
For a wedding.
A wedding?
Yeah.
In Cartagena?
She got invited to a wedding that only cost
$6,000. By a Colombian drug lord?
What? That's not what you were saying about Cartagena. You think it's crazy that people invite you to a wedding that you have to spend like $10,000 on.
Yeah, then they want a present on top of it.
Yeah, that's why they give you a year. That's why they give you a year to do the present for cash flow.
You know how I feel about this, Patrick. If you invite someone to a party, if it's actually a party, you should be paying for it. That's what a party is.
Well, so do you disagree with people forcing you to rent a tuxedo for a wedding?
Yeah, yes, for many reasons, including it's squashing their First Amendment rights to wear whatever they want.
I know, or to presume that people are going to dress terribly.
I don't know. Maybe your friends aren't that menschy and they don't own suits and ties.
Well, our guests for the Weekly Grill are Jonathan Tillis, executive sous chef, and Tim Caspare, chef de cuisine of Pasquale Jones.
Thanks for having us. Good to be here.
It's awesome. Your restaurant's on the Lower East Side. It's very successful. Also, calling in Eric Koss, who is the publisher of the Alameda Sun, an independently run newspaper in Northern California since 2001.
I'm very excited about that. I obviously, and we all do here at Heritage Radio, support an independent media. An independent newspaper is righteous. It's a righteous thing, Patrick.
It is a righteous thing. And actually, yes, I do see a lot of parallels between an independent print publication and Heritage Radio.
We should
start
a printing press right here.
We're using old technology.
The Gutenberg division.
Exactly. Gutenberg. And then who gets credit for the radio again?
Well, Marconi, but Edison and Tesla certainly had something to do with it as well.
Wow. All right. So a recent
Scott Muni.
By the way, in our weekly based, we cover important topics of the day and give very useful dinner kind of conversation insight into it. We know nothing about any of these subjects. So a recent study shows that 37% of Americans don't get enough protein. And so they declared National Protein Day on February 27th. Is lack of protein an issue in your minds for America?
I want to know who this they is, first of all. Who's the they that declared National Protein Day? Because it's not the 37% of Americans that don't get enough protein, which is what your question seems to suggest. Obviously, this is some part of the food industry, you know, that's promoting something, God knows what. I'm really sick of, like, something National Day. I mean, let's have National Mike Edison Day. Then again, every day is National Mike Edison Day.
Yes, in your mind.
In my mind. I don't get it. I mean, I love protein. I just, I like to eat a steak. I like to eat fish. I get protein from vegetables.
I was under the impression that Americans ate too much meat to begin with.
Exactly.
And now we're declaring a day to eat more meat.
It's like, don't we eat enough meat and cheese in this country, seeds and nuts and sushi?
Yeah.
I was saying someone declaring National Protein Day and declaring that's an issue is like Boar's Head, promoting Boar's Head in the Boar's Head cafeteria.
I mean, we need a national, farmer's market day more than we need.
Yes. Oh, very nice.
You know.
Well, I mean, I think people need to, be aware of nutrition. I'm not a nutritionist, so I have no idea, what this means. Or, I glance at something on the internet just to find out where people are getting their protein. I live with a vegetarian who pushes quinoa. I know it's tough. Pushes quinoa on me. She's dairy friendly, though, so we do cheese, seeds, nuts, quinoa, broccoli's got protein in it. Certain beans do. Certain legumes, lentils have protein. Me, I eat a fucking steak.
So that's a vegan thing, you think? You think that was a vegetarian who started National Protein Day?
Well, dairy, I don't know. I mean, but there's vegetable protein. To me, it's not satisfying. Otherwise, I would probably go there.
Right.
I mean, unless I get that pork, that tomahawk pork chop.
Right.
I'm just not a happy camper, but I don't know, National Protein Day. Well, just wait till we get to National Meatball Day, which is coming up.
Right, that is, right. That's a better day. Well, Mike really thinks there's too many days, like in Seinfeld, where there were too many holiday songs, you know, at the office kind of thing.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, so what did you wear for the National Protein Day parade?
A tuxedo. Emily made me wear a tuxedo. She's
a big
national
day for you.
Yeah, it was a big day. So this is a
national destination wedding day.
This is a serious. We're going to get real serious. By the way, if we're The View, I always like to say I'm Joy Behar. I think I'm Joy Behar on The View. You're more Whoopi Goldberg, color commentator.
I'll take that. Color commentator, Whoopi, really? Really, you want to go there?
Color commentator. Color commentator.
Did you say
color
commentator? Did you say that? Sorry. The colored commentator?
Is the formal restaurant a dying breed? Or is it getting stronger? What I mean by formal restaurants are reservations, waiters, sommeliers, you know, appetizers, main desserts, after dinner drinks.
I mean, I think these things sort of, two things. I think they come in waves, and so trends change, and people's appetite for, you know, that type of dining changes over the years. But I also think they need each other. So if you have casual restaurants, you need fine dining because you still want places to celebrate special occasions. And if you only have casual restaurants, there will be sort of a longing for a more, I guess the word is, you know, more elevated service.
I love elevated service. And I think there's a place where, you know, fine dining, but I think the world has changed and such. And I guess maybe Bobo, we were talking about before because of what's in the news lately, but at Bobo, it's something to do with it. I mean, I can go in there and hear the Led Zeppelin and feel like I don't need to like wear my rented tuxedo, you know, that I didn't return from the destination wedding, you know, to have dinner. I mean, I can go in there and I do want to have a cocktail and I do want to have an appetizer and I do want to try different things and I want to order a good bottle of wine and I want someone to advise me on my wine purchase.
Right.
I want to drop some coin, but I don't. It's not stuffy. It's relaxed. It's
absolutely
cool. I love that experience. So,
well, by the way, I'm not.
So I'm talking about. I'm like, it's casual. Plus, I mean, it's not stuffy. It's not like what would have been fine dining for my parents, which was never any fun.
By the way, no, the ritual is still the same. Even casual dining as a waiter, it's a sommelier, it's a 2-hour meal. I mean, I was thinking more like that. It's not so much an issue in and of itself, but like in New York. So we're going to talk later about Hudson Yards. You know, where you have 80 new restaurants opening with 12,000 seats and stuff.
Boo, hiss.
One of our co-mentors is Mark Ladner.
Absolutely.
So he starts Pasta Flyer, and Nick Anderer starts Martina,
right,
both of which are closed.
That's
and
right.
Yet what they were trying to do was almost self-serve restaurant. They were trying to take away. I almost thought Martina was a threat to Danny Meyer's, you know, traditional thing where you want people to sit and the tip included. You know, that's where you just get your pizza. You're in and out in 6 minutes.
But I think there's room for both.
Yeah,
and fine dining will never disappear because there will be an appetite, at least in New York, for opulence.
Yeah,
and I think there is going to be. There's some tradition in it that will, you know, never go away.
I mean,
there's
event dining. I think that's very important, you know, birthdays, destination weddings.
But it's just so funny.
But
no, well, I actually, I haven't been in the restaurant business basically for almost 20 years and also with slow food. I really enjoy bar food that's done great or just the untraditional thing. Because the sit down thing, I think I just eat too much. I get gluttonous.
Well, you
and
can't
I,
do it all the time and it's time consuming.
That's
but
the
no,
best part.
But listen, all food should be good. You know, we say this all the time. We live in New York City. This is the covenant that's been established because I pay a lot of money to live here in rent and taxes. It's hard to live here. So that, you know what that means? I should never eat bad pizza. Okay? That's okay? Okay? It shouldn't fucking exist because I'm paying a high premium for the privilege of living here. So everything should be good. And when I go into a bar, the wings should be good. They should be better than the wings are in Cleveland or in Wisconsin because it's more expensive to live here, and it's just, everything should be better here.
So, Tim, what do you think? Is the restaurant a dying, formal restaurant, a dying breed, or is it getting stronger?
Well, I think there's two terms here. There's formal, right, which is what you're talking about. You're talking about stuffy, uncomfortable places. You know, as a kid, you wear a scratchy sweater to go there. My brother and I actually had a rating system for restaurants we went to. Like, the stuffier it was, the more sugar packets we like dumped on the floor because it was just like wasn't fun, you know. But I think we're talking about formal restaurant. We appreciate luxury, and then in the same sense, you're talking about also, you know, what is special. You know, what is like the new luxury? New luxury is like going to Copenhagen and going to dinner at a place like Noma, or like taking a plane, then a train, and getting yourself up to Favikin, where that's not formal, but that's a new luxury. That's mm-hmm. special. These products that are made in these restaurants don't exist anywhere else.
Well, that's true.
You know what I mean? So I think formal, I never liked formal. I like luxury.
I like luxury too. And that's what I was talking about before. I mean, formal dining, you know, it could be like, might as well be a rock and roll experience. I mean, why not? I don't want to wear a scratchy sweater. Yeah. I don't want to wear my worst clip-on tie when I'm 12 years old and be forced to, go Absolutely. Through this awful ritual. No, I want to get a little loose. I want to have some fun.
Yeah.
I want to tuck into the best of the best. And I know it's going to cost some money, and I have good enough manners. I can, I'm allowed to dine in public.
Really?
Yes.
excuse me, guys.
You never take me to French chat, and if you would, you'd find out.
No, I just think it's funny. There are very few. It's interesting that Martina and Pasta Flyer failed. They were essentially giving you great pizza and great pasta, almost high-end pasta, with nothing. It was just, it was a nice room, but there was no waiter. You had to clear your own
table. He's ahead of his time. I really think
I think there's going to be more and more of those people who want the loop of pasta, but in 3.5 minutes, and then they're out. They're eating on the street. And yet, I think Americans weren't ready for it. They couldn't understand that the Pasta Flyer pasta was as good as the loop of pasta, stripped of all of the extra expense. The time,
tablecloth, the team, et cetera, the plateware.
People are having a hard time parsing out casual versus fast food. That's sort of a nebulous.
I told him he should go full fast food. Have the pictures of the pasta with number 1, 2, 3, 4. Try to emulate McDonald's, because I think that would have been the format people got.
Emulate the Tokyo Subway system.
People don't eat pasta like that.
It's true.
It's not in the family of foods that you can just go. Smash a around the corner and smash a bowl of
he rigatoni. Made it that way, but you're know, right, but it I wasn't think people don't think of it that like way that.
Yeah, no, there's no reference point for it.
Why is it that you go all these every bar you go to, there's there's a chicken wing, there's some sort of salty
you can't
thing.
Eat it with your hands.
It's just like
this is a great segue to a thing. Let's jump and then we'll come back to the other one. Happy Meatball Day. Now
God, another fucking day? Another is this National Day? International Day?
We celebrate meatballs all the time.
Well, what did you wear for the Meatball Day parade, Patrick?
Now, back in the day, meatball was a term of derision for you and your generation. You call someone a meatball, you were ready to murder their family.
Meatball.
How dare you? That guy's a meatball. All right. No, but we were talking about chains. My buddies at the meatball shop opened 7 meatball shops. And in a weird way, I think the meatball was something that 15 years ago, New Yorkers could not just go. Well, I guess they could at pizza places, right? A meatball sub.
I say, meatballs are the best value on any menu. If you really want to, you go to some of these old Red Sauce joints or any place, you order the meatballs, $9 or $12, and it's 3 giant meatballs. Talk about protein. And it's great. It's enough for 2 people.
It's usually considered a side as well.
I know. And it's like and the way they make meatballs these days, 3 grapefruit-sized meatballs.
I thought the book you wrote with Joe Bastianich said Jews always ordered veal because it was
the
best.
Did not say that.
Oh, no.
Oh, it did not say that.
No, I'm Jewish, so I can joke. I'm Jewish, but who orders veal?
Jews.
Okay.
But the book didn't say that.
Italians. Oh, I see.
Hey, guys. Did you know today is also National Cereal Day?
Oh, please.
Oh, is that Eric Koss, the publisher of the Alameda Sun since 2001?
I'm a National Cereal Killer Day.
Could we have more?
I am. I just had to jump in because it's not only is it National Cereal Day, but it's National Be Heard Day.
You see?
This is like Little House on the Prairie days. I didn't even know you heard it. This is a radio station with a print newspaper guy on. This is as old technology as this station has ever gotten. Well, welcome, Eric. So National Cereal Day, not Kellogg. You mean whole grain cereal, or is it sponsored by Kellogg's?
Oh, God.
I'm sure it is on some level. Every day of the year is associated with some kind of food product. And I'm pretty sure that's all just promotional stuff.
It's Tony the Tiger. Happy Meatball Day, by the way.
Tony the Tiger is a
spokesperson.
What
do I think of it?
No, Happy Meatball Day is a good day, no?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And my mom makes the greatest meatballs on the planet, so, I'm a big meatball
fan. Does Pasquale Jones make, or does your restaurant group, Charlie Bird, anyone make a meatball?
It's a funny story, I resisted it because, I'm not Italian, right? I'm kind of a dumb Irish kid from Jersey. But I did live in Italy. I did work there. I do speak Italian, and I'm conversant with the idea that meatball is not meant to be put on top of spaghetti. But mm-hmm. because of the kind of restaurant we have, right? We have this restaurant as a combination of like high and low. We've got fine dining, sort of trained people, high level wine list. And we've got some casual food and some food that's pretty elevated for where we're serving it.
Sure.
So I resisted the idea of that because I think it has a connotation, right? A meatball just sounds kind of like clunky meat, you know, meatball.
It's hilarious,
you know. But
doesn't sound refined.
You know, here's the thing: I was like, "This is me. This is where I came from." I was like, "Okay, let's try. We'll put it on the menu. See what happens." Because we're getting these great pigs. Obviously, you know about that. Wow.
HeritageFoods.com.
Heritage Foods, yeah. But
thanks, Jeff.
So I put it on the menu as veal and ricotta polpettone. Nobody knows what that is. Nobody ordered it. So, like, we, you know, we would just call it, eventually wind up calling it a meatball. And we don't serve it on top of spaghetti.
And it went great guns.
Yep.
What's that? Yeah.
Well, because everybody wants a great version of a meatball. I think everyone is dying to be like, I got the best meatball of all time.
I think it's a pretty good meatball.
Yeah, well, no, it is very good. We actually...
we should dedicate a show to meatballs. You know, I talked to, like, when the Daniels were on for the meatball shop, I always talk to those guys, like, after the show about meatball technique. They've been very helpful.
Did you see what he made? He made a 10-pound meatball for Meatball Day on Rachel Ray. With cheese in it.
All right, if that's the one thing that came out of Meatball Day, in that case, I'm for it.
It's all Heritage, dude. It's good. It's saving the world. So
because it's Meatball Day or Cereal Day, what does that mean?
Albondigas.
See, what is that?
Yo no conozco los.
What is that?
It's like, I don't know. I get them at the Mexican restaurants out here. It's like Mexican meatballs. They're kind of like giant, loose meatballs in a very soupy spaghetti sauce kind of thing. They're really good.
And in Spain, it would be more like in a brown sauce. It would be smaller and tighter. Yeah. Brown albondigas.
What were you going to say, Chef?
No, just great. You know, it's Cereal Day. What does that ask of me? That it's National Cereal Day. What am I supposed to do?
Run out and get some Lucky
Charms. Have some cereal this morning?
Yeah, it said marshmallows.
Seriously.
This is Toucan Sam's doing the talk shows.
Now, when we look at fast food, it's funny. So much stuff, you know, we're like controlled and like programmed by, you know, what we're marketed and everything. So why do American fast food chains avoid dark meat? Does it really taste that different? What is behind the don't put dark meat in our McNugget? If there's dark meat in there, people want to. And promoting white meat. What is really, from a culinary perspective, what is the fear of dark meat? Is it really a taste thing?
I don't
thing?
Know. You know what? I mean, I'm going to hop off topic real quick, but pork is a good example because the pork that we get, again, from Heritage Foods, it's not the other white meat. It's the other red meat. It's dark. It's flavorful. And some guests comment, they're like, "Oh, this. You sure this is cooked? Is it okay? Is it off? It's not, you know, perfectly that you know soapy white kind of color." Which maybe that's a perception. I mean, maybe the visual part for some people
it's a color thing exactly.
The average person buying, you know, a McNugget anywhere in the country.
Well, first of all, a McNugget is not even...
I don't know.
It's so far removed from the actual chicken, you know, and everything is in there.
You say goo.
That's goo. It's not even chicken. It's chicken goo. It's not white meat. It's everything. It's like chicken... Yeah. I mean, Lord knows what's in a fucking McNugget. I mean, seriously.
Well, I also think it's, with the exception of, you know, Popeyes and KFC, you know, it's proximity to the bone. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the sort of fast food... You know, they want just something that is off the bone, easy to eat, and that ended up being white meat.
Well, Mike, tell your story about the biology. I didn't even think of that when I wrote the question.
Well, this is your business.
I can't believe I didn't think of it.
This from you, Patrick.
So say it.
Because this is what, you know, Heritage Foods, what your business is. You always say about heritage breeds and the genetics is that, I mean, even if chickens are raised well, their genetics have been so selected for chickens that are unhealthy, meaning they grow to be obese, their breasts grow so fast that their cardiovascular systems can't support this rapid growth. So that's, you have these chickens that grow in a matter of weeks, giant breasts, which are white meat, to produce things like chicken tenders and chicken breasts.
This is bona fide truth. They do a thyroid. They mess with the thyroid to create big breasts or it grows too fast. And they do breed a diminutive gene into the legs. So it is naturally already producing less dark meat than any chicken in history. So that they have that type of control over the breeding.
It's strange because chickens, I mean, if you get like a real chicken that had, you know, had a real life, the
its
legs
are
it's
huge.
Opposite. The legs are huge.
And well, it's not even that.
Kind of sinewy, and the breasts are relatively small.
And by the way, when people say, "Oh, how do you judge a heritage turkey? What label?" I'm like, no label. You look at the breast. If it's a basketball, it's not heritage. Right. If it's a high keel bone, thin breast, massive legs, it's heritage.
And that's tough because a lot of people don't like that because they want a lot of yield of breast meat.
And that's the logistics of what we're talking about. If you're talking about yield of meat and how easy it is to process, you know, then you talk about that chicken with the huge breasts.
And even
if legs are a pain to debone unless you're
right. Even if it's been raised, on pasture, yeah, whatever, it's still been raised not to be healthy because of the genetics, because of its genetic line. It's, you know, been selected.
Because two companies produce all the poultry in the world. Two countries are the hatching genetics for where every single person in the world buys their chickens, from backyard chickens all the way thing, with the exception of Frank and a few farmers who over 200 years have just kept the lines going from farm to farm. It is wild how conglomerated that business has gotten. Well, talking about conglomeration, there's a conglomeration of restaurants happening at Hudson Yards. It's a big article in the Times. People have been talking
about
it.
That's where I'm going to have my destination wedding,
so
Hudson Yards.
So many new food places are about to open. Do you worry it's too much? I mean, I'm not talking a lot. I'm talking like 60 different food businesses are opening basically in the Hudson River. What do you guys think about that whole complex?
Someone's going to have to feed all those douchebags.
Stop. All right. Come
well,
on.
I think so the volume housing units they created is upwards of what, 20,000 or, I mean, it's so it's
so you're saying more people are going to be moving there? Or?
Yeah, and there's no restaurants to service
all
the people living in
that area.
It's
like a college campus.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been there, but
college
it's huge.
It's like a city in the sky. It's like one of those, you know, utopian, you know, science fiction movies of like the cloud city where the rich people live.
It doesn't resemble
New York at all. You know, Tom Cruise or, you know, whatever. And then it's all going to go bad. You've seen the movie. You know, it's going to go bad.
Why? Why? You're
talking because the workers are going to revolt because the people mining the you know, can't get enough of it, aluminium shit, that needs to power the city. You're all getting weird diseases, and then they're going to protest and lock the prime minister in the room with like the miners. Haven't you seen that episode of Star Trek?
What's that movie? Minority.
Minority Report. There's another one too. It's like, dude, this is a disaster for. Is a recipe for disaster.
Mike said when he
read
that.
Dude, I never want to go there. I hope I die without ever stepping foot in that fucking place.
Well,
I think it's good. I think
some point
is good.
There are going to be too many. It might not be now. It might be in 30 years. At some point, too many restaurants will exist. Too many food shops for too few people. It's not yet. There's now a Whole Foods at every. There's either a Whole Foods, a Fairway, a in every little niche of New York.
And they're all packed all the time.
I mean, isn't it ever going to hit? When will it hit that peak and start to go down? Sometime.
Unclear.
Maybe it's in 50 years. No one's eating at home. I mean, when I read how many restaurants, I mean, there are food halls that, I mean, even the Neiman Marcus
has
had
three
multiple
restaurants. In it.
Restaurants.
Yeah. My issue with it, really, I think, is as someone who loves to dine out in New York, I think it's very sort of romantic to get on the train, go to a restaurant, go to a new neighborhood, and go there.
Love it.
That's true. I hate eating in my own neighborhood.
And as someone who didn't grow up in mall culture, it feels like going to a mall to eat dinner. And I just don't know if that feels special enough to get on the elevator.
Well, actually,
and say,
to a New Yorker, it does feel special because
I've never
grown up with the mall, born and raised on the Upper East Side. You too, Brooklyn. No
totally.
Malls, right?
But I just doesn't. I don't know if it appeals to me as a place where I want to go spend a sort of nice evening.
So, Eric, can you talk to us about Alameda, Northern California? Are there? You have Ferry Plaza, right? And then I know in Napa they did that kind of center near that old museum. What about these malls packed with restaurants? Is that a phenomenon there? Or even your wharf there in Oakland, right?
Yeah, I don't know if you'd really call it a phenomenon. It's just trying to get different areas to be attractive to people and have them come enjoy all the different offerings. I guess you're referring to Jack London Square, which has come along quite a bit.
Has it?
With some...
Or did it fail? Is it a failed thing?
No, it's definitely coming around some more. Some recent, like, kind of hipster restaurants with, like, you know, one-word names have been cropping up. A place called Plank and things like that. And there's some places that have been combining things like bowling and arcades with food and drink and making a go of it like that.
There is sort of a real
just
magic.
Just a lot of entrepreneurs out here
to go into a place like, let's say Stone Barns, or like if you're going to go to
a real destination,
you know, Michel Bras restaurant, you know,
or like, Roberta's used to be that itself along the
pilgrimage.
L train. It was a destination.
Just like, you know what, that's part of the experience. You go to this place, it becomes. This can't exist anywhere else. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You guys want another room, you just bring in another shipping container, just cut a hole in it, and, you know, boom, got another dining room. That can't exist. You can't take that out of here and have it still be the same. So that's maybe part of the charm of, like, you know, this little restaurant we got in the corner at Pasquale Jones. It's like, you're in downtown, you're in Mulberry Street.
We're going to talk about that later. What an interesting street.
Take that somewhere else, it becomes something different. You know, people actually come, they stop me on the street and they say, hey, where's the Little Italy sign in the street? You know, like, welcome to Little Italy.
But I agree, but to me, that's New York. It's like to go and say, hey, we're going to go down to Mulberry Street. We're going to go to, I love Chinatown. You know, I mean, the East Village is not what the East Village used to be, but sometimes it's nice to be there and get a good dose. I live in Brooklyn now. I love my neighborhood. And I love, by the way, I wish there were better local restaurants because some of them disappeared, because sometimes I just want to walk.
Where, in Cobble Hill?
Yeah, I want to walk a couple blocks and sit down and have, you know, whatever, a great dinner. Sometimes I don't want to travel. Sometimes I don't mind. I mean, I'm happy to go into Manhattan.
I pick
for
one local restaurant that I go to all the time, but basically, if I'm going to do something special, we have pizza place basically, but I always want to leave. I always want, if not, I'm not, I haven't passed a threshold. That's why I love going to Pasquale Jones. I was like walking through the Lower East Side, then we went to dessert at the Chinese ice cream company. You know,
but
and
that's
it's just
what New York's supposed to be. And this is why I hate things like Hudson fucking Yards. Because what it does is it removes any sense of neighborhood whatsoever. This has all been prefabricated. Right. It's all been cooked up in some urban planner, you know, design book with a bunch of like architects planning for billionaires. It's all a bunch of like law offices. I mean, this is like many times bigger, I think, than what the Amazon campus was supposed to be. Right. You could live there and never leave. I mean, you could literally be, someone could be born there. They have a hospital there? They probably do, right? Be born there and never leave. The implications of this are just horrible.
But by the way, I will say, Amazon not coming, big mistake for everybody, including the dummies that were protesting.
As is. You're
they all
say,
want business. All the businesses want money. We could use another 1,000. It would have people. It would have helped. 10,000.
I think there's a lot of gray area in here, and I think people just want to take sides. You know, people just want to take sides because they don't want this capitalist Bezos culture.
You know, New York is much bigger than Bezos.
And on the other, you know,
he's just a cog in the wheel.
People are just too quick to take sides on that and not get into.
All right,
you know,
can we be welcoming for a second to people from the West Coast? We have Eric Koss, the publisher of an independent newspaper, the Alameda Sun, since 2001. Mazel tov. Congratulations for keeping that an independent newspaper going in this era when they're all closing. So I throw this to you first, but then our whole panel. The mainstream media, what are its shortcomings as relates to food or other things too?
Goodness. Do you have like 2 hours to go on and on? But
give us the 3-minute version.
Well, you know, to kind of segue from the food thing, I've had somebody recently refer to me as like the Alice Waters of newspaper. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous, but we take it like it's an art project every week. We're like these artisans handcrafting our newspaper. We have local talent that write in every week.
Do you make the physical paper?
Do you make the paper?
Well, we outsource that. We get it printed, but we design each page ourselves. It's not done by software or anything like that, or people in other countries. Everybody is pretty much local here to our city and knows our city really well. So
food media, I mean, what's missing? I mean, chefs, I asked that to you too. I mean, how do you cover food? Do you have a food section?
Well, yeah, we do have a writer that does include some food topics every now and then, but in general, we don't like to really judge our local restaurants quite as harshly as maybe the Times or other papers do. We want to encourage everybody to be successful, and in general, that just has worked for us. A really bad review can really put a little mom-and-pop business like right out of town.
But the fact that you respond that way shows how shitty our food journalism is, because food should not just be, you know, Pete Wells, who I can't stand. I'm just so sick of reading his opinion still. That's not food. I'm talking about gastronomy in all of its facets: biology, sociology, anthropology, cooking, technology, global warming, the environment. That's what I want the food section to be. And I'll say, our generation is being robbed, capital R-O-B-B-E-D, by the food section of the New York Times. It should be the section that we are reading. New Yorkers, young kids are reading, and it doesn't cover any of the things I just mentioned. It covers one thing: pots and pans and fluffy stories. And I want global warming. Like, shit, that's real.
Well, Patrick, I don't think anybody's arguing with that.
Yeah.
Why don't they add some articles?
But I think you've got an agenda, Patrick. And you know, I know you were dying to say that you hate Pete Wells. You know, you'd like to put a jihad on the motherfucker. Come on, you'd love to if you
could.
The Alameda Sun and what Eric's doing is not relevant to that. I think what Eric is saying, and I think it's correct, and it's an important part of being a regional and a local media, is to be a cheerleader for your community.
Yeah, well, that's one part of it. But I just want to point out that you said, the food section has been robbed or whatever. But all of journalism has been robbed by the big media companies who consolidated, tons and tons of these little newsrooms into a big conglomerate news media outlet that serves no one but their bottom line. Yep.
So how do you stay independent?
Well, we've had people come by here and try to, buy into the paper, but we immediately could sense that they had some kind of political agenda or some other kind of, like, I don't know, other idea than just printing the news. And if you're here to, like, make money, guess what? This isn't the place to be doing that. You make money in financial businesses. In this business, you do journalism. That's what you're supposed to be doing, and you're supposed to be very clear about it. Whether you're stating fact or opinion needs to be a very clear line, and whether you're trying to tell a story or sell something needs to be a very clear line. And I thought that was known and established in the industry, but everybody just seems to have forgotten that.
Oh, Eric.
You're talking to the former publisher of High Times. He really knows.
Hey, but, listen, I know. I think Eric's right. I think what you're doing is righteous. And
so what do you guys think? Where do you guys go for food news? I mean, I'm just trying to stir up shit with the Times and stuff like that, saying that we need more voices and more things to be covered. But Eater, I mean.
Well, the community basically writes our paper for us. If you want people to be reading the paper, then you should probably put the stuff that they wrote in the paper, because then you know they'll be looking at it. And if the community is telling you that they want to see something in your paper, well, that's a pretty good clue that you should probably put it in.
Right.
It doesn't always have to be you telling the story.
Well, this is a paper serving the community, not serving advertisers, whatever you're trying to say.
I just think, with social media is not, very new, but It at this point it has saturated a lot of a lot of the avenues that people used to kind of sorry, I've been like really sick, so I'm just trying to hang out,
Sorry, man. And thanks for having me, guys, if I didn't say it already.
No, I only mean to say that clickbait is everywhere, and if Eater markets a lot of stories, and there's a ton of information out there, and it's actually hard to kind of find out the legitimate news stories with all of the spots they do on
where to get the best ramen or whatever. Bot and
But also a lot of the stories they publish are a paragraph long. They're not full stories.
And it's a lot of junk. Right. It's a lot of stuff that's written very quickly. Yeah, exactly. It's not
a lot
edited.
Of junk.
It's by
junk news, like junk food, right? It's sort of like fast food of news up there on social media and the 24-hour news cycle. I mean, you can eat that news, but it's not going to sit well. If you consider the source and choose a more considered news outlet, you might actually get a better meal out of it.
Agreed. It's funny, unhealthy.
We open the restaurant, we put this pizza on the menu. It's like, clams and cream and lemon, et cetera. And it's tasty, and it really took off. People really enjoyed it. It became really hard to take off the menu, and it also became this thing that was like, the hot story when we opened the restaurant. And a lot of different media came to us and said, hey, we really want to shoot the clam pizza. Like, well, it's out there already. Like, how many other people have already came here to do this story on this clam pizza? It's like, it's already out there. You don't need to do another story about it. We've already photographed it.
Right.
We're done with it. Right.
Also,
let's move on.
Also, we have a lot of people working,
it's not news.
These websites. No. These websites don't pay a lot of money. And you have young people trying to make their bones for a few dollars for a story. I mean, these websites pay for a blog, $15, $25.
Right. It's not like you get paid tens of thousands of dollars even just for a few words.
Well, listen, I believe in the democracy of the internet. I believe that the barrier to entry needs to be removed, so it's not just Pete Wells and Pete.
Everyone can be a critic.
On the other hand,
everyone can be a critic.
Yes. On the other hand, you also talk that, you know, Yelp is a failed system because the man on the street may not be qualified to judge your restaurant.
I hate man on the street interviews. Jonathan, tell me about
Yelp,
the weather.
How many Yelpers post positive reviews? Yelp is the avenue for people to vent instead actually talking to their...
Right. Where better to go to how the Mets are going to do this year than Jonathan? What do you think?
Yeah, hot takes from Brooklyn, you know?
I cannot stand man on the street interviews. I'm like, dude, I like you, but, yeah, but why are you talking about Donald Trump?
But you know what? There are so many people who are qualified. I mean, you know some great sports fans, you know, who really do have good opinions. You know, people who know a lot about food but aren't food media professionals who have great opinions. You know, friends who would say, Patrick, you got to try. You got to go to Jeet's restaurant because it's fantastic. You know, and you say, wow, you know.
Jeet's like, I have a restaurant?
You know, Bobo said Jeet's place is the best. It's got to be the best. I didn't read it in the paper. I heard it from someone I trusted. Audience of one.
I'll tell you
audience
exactly.
Of one, you.
Do you know the strategy for the conglomeration of the news media? They're like, we've conglomerated everything. None of our news is real anymore. We'll do more man on the street interviews to counter the perception. We will get people on the street who have no business talking about a certain subject other than that we saw them come out of their car when we had the mic out and asked them their opinion. And so you think, oh, this is really the people, or that little sob story that I heard about this girl in Seattle that lost her leg makes me feel like that's a good news organization. I'm like, no, it's still shitty news. That's a cool story maybe, but it's still shitty news, you know?
I mean, we need more than just reviews and scandal. You know, that's
local
all
tragedies. Yeah. Well, let's
local,
talk.
That's a good word to use because that's the part that's missing. Is all of those local newsrooms have been sucked up into the big conglomerates and the local people are not being served. And I think that's why my paper is still here, because we fiercely stay local. We only cover Alameda. We never cover San Francisco, Oakland. Cool. What's that? Never heard of it. You know,
that's so local. You're like, we're not international. Well, I'm like, are you calling Oakland international? You're like, we're just Alameda, dude.
Local news is very important.
I want a local news station. There's a local Brooklyn show to cover like what's happening on my floor, on my apartment building. There's the elevator's on 12. I'm like, that's a good news station. By the way, I will say the fast news cycle keeps the younger generation from having core beliefs and things that they stand for. I'm always like, civil rights? How could you forget that was just a few decades ago? It's because of the fast news cycle, or the Holocaust people forget. Even, by the way, do you remember?
I'm not.
It's all
you're bringing up like
paparazzi.
I think we should unpack that.
Paparazzi used to be hated.
It's
paparazzi
like 4 years
used
at a
to
good
be
school
hated, and now they're
might
loved
be just enough.
People forget. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and do the interview.
How long
is
the break going to be? I'm suggesting 4 years undergrad and then 3 years of graduate school.
Hey, there was a through line.
We'll see you guys in 7 years.
What up?
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dave Arnold, and I'm the host of Cooking Issues here on Heritage Radio Network. Every week, I answer listeners' questions on the latest innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients in the food world. Have a question about hot rotting your oven to make great pizza? Give us a call. Hydrocolloid, sous vide, liquid nitrogen? No problem. You can find Cooking Issues wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right. We are back. We are in studio. I'm Patrick Martins. Our host, other host today is Mike Edison.
I'm at the bar.
And who's at the bar. And our guests for the Weekly Grill are Jonathan Tillis, the executive sous chef, and Tim, am I pronouncing this right, Casper?
Yeah, that's right.
Tim, I'm not seeing Chef any tomorrow.
Chef de Cuisine of Pasquale Jones on the Lower East Side. Also calling in is Eric Koss, publisher of the Alameda Sun. So, Jonathan and Tim, first question goes to you. Tell us, what makes your restaurant group, Delicious Hospitality, unique? It includes Charlie Bird, Legacy Records, and Pasquale Jones. Like, really, what makes it unique? Because there's a lot of restaurants out there. What do you do?
Just to start off, you know, it's not my restaurant group. I work for a great bunch of guys, Ryan Hardy, Grant Reynolds, Robert Bohr. Two of those guys are actually wine professionals.
Robert Bohr is a wine professional. Yeah, I've known him early on.
He's a big part of that company. And Ryan Hardy, the basically the chef owner, is the culinary side of it. So they have essentially now three partners, three restaurants. I had a couple really great conversations when I talked to these guys about coming on to the projects. And mostly about the idea of, you know, you go to a restaurant, what do you like about the restaurant? Can be kind of this hands-off approach. I mean, if you've been in at restaurants for a long time, you go to restaurants a lot, you're a chef or whatever, you go to a restaurant, some of the things that really stick with you are, you know what, if I'm done with my meal, why can't I just pay and leave? You know, like this idea that hospitality is actually like this thing that, you know, can be dynamic. It doesn't have to be this person that comes to your table is asking you if you want dessert. You say yes, they leave. Or they drop a menu and then they leave, and then you have to wait for them to come back to order dessert. Then you get the service attention, you order a dessert, it takes another 15 minutes to get it. You try and get the check, they don't have the check for you.
So I just you're ready leave. To close out, you know, after mean? The main.
Well, that sounds like bad service, actually.
There's a lot of restaurants
that. No,
that's
how they are. That's what I meant by the formality of restaurants, which they break a little bit.
You know what, if you're really, you know, thinking about it, all I want to do at the end of my meal is like have something sweet, maybe have a little Amaro, and get out and just leave. Right. Can you please let me pay?
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think it's not unusual to go to a restaurant and say, hey, you know what? Bring the desserts. I'm going to have a coffee and bring the check.
So that's you are breaking a little bit some of the tenets of traditional formal.
Because, I mean, at the restaurants, for example, Pasquale Jones, we drop water on the table. It's complimentary. It's filtered. It's great. And you pour it yourself.
Yeah, I agree.
Some people are like, they didn't pour our water. I can't believe this place.
Well, I think hopefully we're getting past that.
Those people
are.
I mean, it's like, come on.
I mean, great service is great service. You know,
great service is tailoring your service to the guest needs. And some guests want to be left alone.
And I will say Roberta's did a lot to show that you don't need traditional servers to culture to be good service.
Well, here at Roberta's, I mean, everybody that serves here knows the menu very well, knows the wine list here very well. And I love the wine list here because it's only 8 or 12 choices, and it covers a spectrum of price points. And they know it. It can be managed. It's not some hoary old binder of things that nobody could possibly comprehend.
The part of the service I think that's really dynamic is that, you know, you can tailor your service to the guest needs. And, you know, if someone wants to be left alone, leave them alone. It's not about the sommelier show. It's not the sommelier's turn to talk about his perspective. You know,
it reminds me
your job as a sommelier, you go to the table, you can talk about the wine, but you know what, like, nobody cares sometimes.
No, sometimes you want it.
No one cares. That's right.
But it reminds me of this New Yorker cartoon, which is this couple sitting at home in their living room, and husband's answering the phone, and the caption is, "It's the waiter from the restaurant. He wants to know if everything is still okay."
Yeah. So, but I only mean to say, to tie it back to the restaurant group, is that that idea of service, I think, is executed very well at these restaurants, mm-hmm. where you have a dynamic level of service. That can be on a very high level, or it can be in a level where you leave the guests alone. It's not your show, it's their show.
But you know who was actually very good at that, to me, was Balthazar. They had a real culture of the back waiter. So all those guys were constantly clearing your water, getting your plate, switching the tablecloth. Yeah, the servers have a huge role in whether you're like, I felt uncomfortable, it was stiff, he was upset.
I mean, what they've cultivated at the restaurants is this idea that, you know... You have professionals that there's no service manual for that.
Yes,
you have to have really attentive people who can be dynamic and change their style of service.
It's also, you know, like with writing, if you really know an idea, you can write it in very few words. And a good waiter is just there at those core moments. They don't have to go through the full script of everything ever written.
Well, just to tag on to what Tim was saying is that, you know, obviously the food and the wine is very dynamic. You can kind of come in for whatever you want. But I think what the restaurants really put at a high premium is fun. I mean, mm-hmm. you notice that from the sort of loud music, mm-hmm. Whether you're at Charlie Bird, Legacy, or Pasquale Jones, like, you're going to hear awesome music. There's going to be great wine if that's what you're there for. There's going to be good food, great drink. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of, like, they want the restaurants to be fun.
Sure.
And it's really...
Why wouldn't it be fun?
Well, maybe you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. You go out sometimes, and it doesn't seem like they thought about whether
about
or not this was going to be a fun
experience.
It's
about the food, yeah.
But, you know, that sounds like you know, a different generation. You know, like, my parents were very stiff and very square, where a restaurant was not fun.
Yeah.
It was, I don't know. I mean, it was like, you know...
I don't always think people have that in their mind when they open a restaurant.
You know, my parents are the kind of people that would take joy in a thing that should be joyous no matter what it was,
right.
You know. But to go to a restaurant and to be so stiff that you couldn't enjoy the meal and get
loose is
ridiculous. And there's no reason why it can't be formal and fun. It can't be elegant and fun. It can't be elevated and fun.
And Legacy is a great example of that.
Legacy Records.
Yeah, I mean, it's by far our sort of, you know, most ambitious project in a
Tell us about that.
Well, it's in an absolutely gorgeous space, and... You know, it feels amazing to be in there.
Where is it?
It's on 38th and 10th. So it's close to the Hudson.
Oh!
I know.
Right on the edge of Armageddon.
That's where he found most of his dates growing up, was right in that same neighborhood.
In the horse stables?
Right.
When it was still stables and railroad yards.
Strip club across the street.
Tell us about your ovens. You have these big ovens at Pasquale Jones. I'm always fascinated by, what did you pick? How hot does it get? So what makes your ovens unique?
People always sit across the bar and you have this conversation about it. You know, they say, hey, you know, how hot does that oven get? And you tell them, and then they just raise their eyebrows and go, oh.
They have no idea what it means.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, 900 Fahrenheit. Oh, that's pretty hot.
Right. Like, they have a reference point.
Like, oh,
for,
okay. Yeah.
They're like, okay,
anyway,
I'll forget
made,
that.
They're made by a mason. His name is Stefano Ferrara. He's just outside of Napoli. The ovens, the flooring is actually made of this volcanic stone. I think they're kind of like the race car of pizza ovens because they're sort of delicate in a way. I think, honestly, you know, a lot of people who get these ovens, you get a couple cracks in them, but they make great pizza.
So you mean they're delicate because if it cracks, it can't hold its high temp?
Well, it does, but I mean, lots of people who buy them have, you know, a crack or two right now, I think, for sure.
So they're delicate, like marble or something.
You know, I think in a sense,
crack,
yeah. I mean, that's just incidental. But anyway, we bought the ovens, which, by the way, don't buy an oven in Napoli from an Italian guy in July, because there's an Italian holiday called Ferragosto, which the further south you go in Italy, the less people work. So we got the ovens, you know, they stopped working on them in August.
I love Napoli, but you said, like, you shouldn't buy an oven from, you know, a guy in Napoli.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to stop there, but it's very specific. Yeah. I mean, Napoli is so famous for crime. Yeah, you know, in Napoli, that's where they wear their watches on their right hand side, right? You know the story, because if you're in your car and you're left hand's out the window, someone's gonna take the watch off your wrist.
They love watches down there. I don't know. I did the same thing. I was there.
It's
actually,
the
same
fucking
trip.
Place, Napoli.
And
I love
because
Napoli.
I understand Italian, I heard some guys talking about, like, oh, these guys got some nice watches here.
So when Chef,
and
when
I
you
took
said
my watch
that
off, put it in my pocket.
The further south you get, the less they work. I once asked my friend, where does that line start? Where they start, and he said, the first town south of you. So
anyway, they're great ovens, and you know, it took us a while to get them.
The Roberta's oven was claimed to have been lost at sea. The guys were like, we're ruined.
Right, these guys put them
lost
on slow boats, right?
Yep, slow boats.
Like,
so who are your mentors? Give me one mentor each, Mike.
Is Eric
this
still
question
online?
Is not for you. Yeah, Eric goes next.
Okay,
he's
going to
get the
Eric
mentor
too.
Question, then we're going to get to Eric's two questions.
I mean, I have two major mentors.
Go, tell us.
Daniel Hume and Michael Tusk.
Oh, shit. Quince, Catonia, 11 Madison Park. Those are pretty top restaurants. Quince is probably, I mean, top restaurant in San Francisco. I mean, the place where you eat literally the best food, right? Or close.
I've been to Quince.
I mean, he, you know, Mike has cultivated so many cool relationships with all these farmers and stuff that, you know, you can't just order the product he gets. It just shows up.
Mm-hmm.
He's got these, you know, kind of handshake agreements with some, you know, these people that, you know, 80 pounds of quinces just show up one day, and you're like, okay, I guess we ordered quinces today. And that's it's
have
like
you
that
been to Verjus
with everything? No, I haven't been out there since they opened that, but I've kind
and
of
Daniel
Hum.
So you work for both these guys?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time both of those guys.
Well, Daniel Hum seems to be doing pretty well for himself. How about you?
I guess I'm going to say Mark Ladner and Mike Anthony.
Shit. Good. Two good guys.
Yeah. I mean, as a young cook, I mean, the real remarkable part is just even as a line cook for both of them, you know, they were both available to me and they were not, you know, these figures that I never got to talk to. I mean, they were there to both teach and really push their vision forward, but also make themselves, you know, accessible to me. And that was pretty special as like a young cook in the industry.
Well, as you know, Mark Ladner took that first trip out there with us and commissioned the Red Wattle Pigs to get grown. That's how I heard it started. So, Eric, who's your mentor, publisher, newspaper man?
Well, I guess I have to say good old Hunter S. Thompson, doctor of journalism. It kind of taught me that there's always something disgusting going on, and the system is always kind of working against you. So just be alert and do the best you can to tell the everyday people how to protect themselves. But the sort of everyday people that made a huge difference in my life would have to be Dennis Evanosky, Julia Park Tracy, Eric Tarowski, Jim Spratley. They've all been my partners over the years, and they've each done a little bit to set the tone of this paper, and they really have all made it possible, so I thank them.
What's your greatest challenge? Just the one thing where we're like, if anyone's thinking about opening a newspaper, the one thing they really have to reckon with.
Oh, just getting over that fear that everybody in the world is saying that newspapers are over, and yet, you know, millions of newspapers are printed every single day, and people do make their livings off of it, and some of us enjoy it.
How do you raise money? Sponsorship, or subscriptions?
Both. You know, subscriptions and advertising, primarily, and basically everything else we can do. We do graphic design services, and we also have a whole history department. We have something like 11 local history books that myself and my partner Dennis Evanosky have been involved in, and we sell those. We do history talks, we do history tours of our local towns, and just so you know, one of those, probably the most famous of those books is San Francisco Then and Now. You might have heard of, there's probably a New York Then and Now or a Manhattan Then and Now or something like that, and this is part of that same series. But Dennis and I work for a London publisher who does these books, and he's contracted us to do a number of them at this point. And those help add to our credibility and all that.
It's a hustle. How many viewers do you have, or readers? See, I say viewers, I'm so used to.
24,000 free copies every week. We have about 7,000 unique visitors to our website, which, by the way, everything that appears in the print edition also appears online.
For free?
So if you purchase, yeah, for free. If you purchase a print advertisement, it also appears online. So I'd just like to say that, you know, all of these websites that are promoting their advertising don't have a print edition. I have a print edition to go with my website, so I have something more to offer than
that. I like that feel of newspaper like in my hands.
Me too. I get the Times delivered.
It's very important, and you know, Eric obviously knows this, but you know, advertisers love print because you know people spend more time with a print ad than they do on a website ad. They're much more likely to respond to a print ad than they are to something they see on the
Carlo
internet.
Carlo Pacini used to say all the time, "How can I grow my slow food movement without something sitting on their dining
room
table?"
Print is fantastic, and I'm always, you know, as someone who's been a print journalist my whole life and writes books seem to be an art, you know, a thing of the past. You know, people, there's a gravitas that comes with print. There's a tactile experience that comes with print. It's, you know, it's not just a bunch of ones and zeros. It lasts. It's durable. It's like affordable luxury. There's so much to be said for print. I do think we should revisit on a future show, though, and have Eric back to talk about what he was getting at about media consolidation, because this is one of the things that we really need to fear in America. What Eric's doing as an independent weekly newspaper is look where the Village Voice is. It's out of fucking business. The Village Voice, one of the great papers in the world, was bought by one of those companies. You know, when two companies basically owned every alternate news weekly in the country, you know, from the LA Weekly to the, what was the paper in San Francisco called? But, you know,
Chronicle?
Chronicle, yeah.
The Guardian.
The Guardian, thank you. And, you know, the Seattle paper just went out of business. I mean, the Village Voice was one of the great bastions of journalism, and they great took away the section. Local reporting. They did great local reporting, and
you
they had their own people.
There?
They had their own people reviewing books, and suddenly, some cat in Phoenix was reviewing books for 15, or then later 30, and then finally, you know, 50 something newspapers. There was no local arts coverage.
Eric, do you have good writers? Do you get good content from your journalism crew, or do you get bad stuff
Absolutely.
And you have to fix it?
Oh, well, yeah, we get plenty of that, too. But I think one of the points on that end is that we kind of set a tone early on that we weren't going to be dumbing down our text for our readers. We're not going to shoot for, like, a fifth grade level or whatever the journalistic trend is. And we were just going to, you know, we have some really erudite people that write for us, including local teachers. And we just kind of let their words stand. We don't try to, like, find a simpler way of saying it.
Mike, what were you trying to do at High Times? What were you shooting for, eighth grade,
seventh grade? Listen, let me tell you something. Boy, you know, I worked at High Times almost 20 years ago, and I'm still wearing that around my neck like
a bastion of honor.
Like an albatross-shaped bong.
You love it.
No, I'm proud of it, of course. But listen, you never write down to the reader. You make the reader come up to you. I mean, I always feel that, you know? When if you ever take a martial art, if you're ever a student of karate, you don't drag the belt down to you. You have to ascend to the belt. And, you know, your readers should feel smart for reading you. You should not, you know, that's very, very important. Otherwise, there's no benefit to it.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
And by the way, Eric, can Patrick come to Alameda and work for you, please?
Yeah, he wants to get rid of me. He wants to use
as an intern,
regicide.
Well, as an unpaid intern, sure. But I just want to point out, I mean, we have a really small staff. That's probably part of the reason why we remain profitable. But I am sitting on a profitable print newspaper in the middle of basically Silicon Valley. Last year, we cleared something like $100,000 on the bottom line. So,
Mike is like, I don't know, that number is too high. I don't understand it. No, that's more than Heritage.
But that's good for us.
That's very good. Congratulations. We're cheering for you. We want you on here. I think you should eventually do one of those shows that send in the podcast so we air your views here on the network as well. Good luck out there. We're pulling for you. If we could buy your copies here, we would.
They're free, Patrick.
You're listening to
Go to alamedasun.com.
And it's also online.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to the main course. Thanks to our chefs. Thanks to Heritage Radio Network. Thanks to our sponsors.
See you guys at Pasquale Jones.
Thanks to G.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening!